witness on my witness. Okay, good morning. We'll get started because we've got a lot to cover. Thanks for coming. We hope this is not our last Lou Jones Breakfast Club of the year. We hope that the government shutdown is resolved one of these days. I do want to warn you, we do have a fabulous program set for November. It's going to be on November 12th, fingers crossed. It's going to be a Supreme Court year in review and a preview of next term. And Pete Blaine from Reinhardt and Tom Schreiner from Foley are going to come on over and give us, you know, what happened last year in the Supreme Court and what are some of the cases. We have that Bellingham case about jurisdiction pending. So they're going to have all the latest information on that. We will keep you posted in the unlikely event that the government is still, or this shutdown thing is not resolved. We probably will be able to have the presentation here. It may affect our ability to go out and do the video. We may not have the technical support to do the video. That's kind of what we're thinking. But we're hoping that none of that happens and that it'll be just business as usual. Again, next month, that's going to be November 12th with a year in review and a preview of what the Supreme Court's got coming. So please mark your calendars, and hopefully we'll be back for that. In December, we have our annual ethics update with Jack Zaharopoulos and Bill Weigel from OLR. So that should be great. You'll get that ethics credit. We always have cookies and treats here. Of course, due to the government shutdown, we have no food here today for you in Milwaukee. No, that's my attempt at government shutdown humor. We are pleased to present today a really important topic, lien stripping in Chapter 13. I'm going to let the panel get right to it. I'm just going to tell you, of course, that we have Judge Pepper, Mike Maloney, Andy Golanowski, and Jay Pittner. So thanks, guys, for giving us this important information, and feel free to ask questions and participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Kelly. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We would tell you, us government employees, to call your congresspersons and advocate for ending the shutdown, but there's nobody answering their phones, so don't bother. We're going to talk today about the best practices procedure for stripping an unsecured or undersecured second mortgage in a Chapter 13. And we sort of have roughly four sections, and so each of us will kind of take one of those topics, but we'll all be chiming in, and we hope that if you have questions or comments or things that you've observed, that you chime in as well. We're looking at the four pieces. Number one, how to draft a complaint so that you get in it what you need to get in it. Number two, how to serve it so that it actually lands where it needs to land and you don't have to keep coming back to the judge for reservice. Number three, how to settle it if, in fact, you're able to get a hold of somebody to settle it. And number four, how to do a motion for default judgment if you're not able to settle it. So, as I said, each of us will take the lead on one of those topics, but we're all going to chime in, and we hope that you do as well. So, Mike, maybe you could help to start talking about the complaint and, you know, what you need to gather and what you need to put in your complaint.
Honestly, it starts a little bit even before the complaint. I mean, for debtors practitioners on these things, you should be thinking about these from the moment you first meet with the debtor and they're telling you about their first and second mortgages. Basically, the starting point for any of it is how much is this house worth and how to determine that. Obviously, Zillow is a tool that you can use online to kind of give an idea of where you're at, but it is not going to be good enough in any type of 506D complaint. I think all the judges agree on that. What I tend to do is I tend to send the debtors off to a broker, Coldwell Banker, Shore West, do free broker comparative market analysis is what they call it. We call them BPOs with the mortgage companies. Get that value. If the value of the property is lower than the amount that's owed on the first mortgage, okay, and sometimes the first mortgage may be a hard number to figure out what that balance is as well, foreclosure complaints, credit reports, the last bill the debtors have, figure it out. But if the value of the house is lower than the first mortgage, you're probably going to be doing a 506D or 1322B strip off of the second mortgage. Once you decide that you're going to be doing that, you need to get documents, and those documents are going to tell you where you need to go. Most importantly, you need a copy of the recorded first mortgage and the recorded second mortgage, and any of the assignments or subordination agreements that are associated with those two documents. Those are going to become very important later on. Lastly, I try to get an affidavit signed by the debtor right away, day one, that says, here's what I think the value of the mortgage is, so that if we do get to a default, I know some of the judges are willing to take an affidavit of the debtor in lieu of testimony. You have that document day one. You don't have to go chasing the debtor to get that or wind up in a situation where the debtor has to come in and testify. In terms of drafting the complaint, my office and the way that we've been doing this lately is there's a lot of problems with these assignment of mortgages and who actually owns the mortgage. It's not proper to put the named party as the servicer, okay? They don't own the mortgage. They aren't the party who you're actually suing. You're suing the person who actually owns the mortgage. And the best place to find that is the last recorded assignment or who's on the actual mortgage at the register of deeds at the courthouse. Now, there's some assignments that tend to show up later on, or you may get proofs of claim from the mortgage company. That's fine, but whoever's at the courthouse is who the state technically is saying is the mortgage holder. That's who you're going to have to put this judgment against when you finish your Chapter 13 and you get your judgment later on.
There can be some confusion. Frequently, the only contact the debtors have are with the loan servicer. They don't know who actually owns the mortgage. So they'll tell their attorney, well, the servicer is who you should name as a defendant. Go ahead. You'll get a judgment against the servicer, avoiding the servicer's mortgage. The servicer doesn't hold a mortgage, so you might not have an enforceable judgment. So as Mike suggests, check with the Register of Deeds office.
Same thing with, we get people coming in and saying, here's the last statement I got trying to get me to pay. Usually that statement's from the servicer, not from the mortgage company. So that may not solve your problem either.
So in terms of named party, the actual person in the caption, it should directly correspond with the last party assigned to or recorded at the Register of Deeds. Now, I know you're saying, well, wait a second, there are a whole bunch of other people that came after that and they might not have put their assignment in. You can notice more people, but the name party should match and correspond with the document that you're actually trying to avoid at the courthouse. And that's basically been what we've been doing. I think it's the best way you can do it. If the mortgage company isn't filing their assignment, that's their fault. I mean, it'd be very hard for them to come in and argue, you didn't give me due process. Well, we didn't know you existed, and we couldn't have known you existed.
There's a variety of players, not only the servicer and the mortgage holder, there's also loan investors who are siphoning off the interest payments on the loan. So there's a lot of players involved. Make sure you get the correct one.
And many of these are available online. I mean, Milwaukee, you can use Tapestry. That'll cover Milwaukee, Ozaukee, several other counties. If you do a quick Google search for whatever county register of deeds, many of them subscribe to Landshark. Landshark is kind of nice because you can actually search for documents for free. You just can't download them, but it narrows down your search. You get the document numbers, and then if you want to pay for the documents, you don't have to go through paying for all these searches. You just search for that document number, and print it off, and just pay for what you want. So they're pretty widely available in most counties online.
Andy, does your office do anything different or anything in addition to what Mike talked about?
No, in fact, sometimes my office doesn't do that.
One of the things that we talked about that I'll just throw in is that having a checklist for your staff of what documents they need to be looking for, what needs to match up to what, as Mike said, you know, who's the entity that's on register at the courthouse, and do my documents match up with that entity? If you have that checklist, I think probably for most of the judges at some point in time, we've either had a prove-up hearing or something, or the attorney comes in and we say, well, you know, we can't tell which mortgage is recorded, which is senior, which is junior. And somebody blinks and goes, well, my people took care of that. Well, if they did, we didn't get it. So, and that's where we start to see the uh-oh, that somebody didn't follow a checklist or whatever else. So having a list is helpful. Jay?
I'm guessing that since the notes are not recorded, ownership of the note is not an issue at all.
Ownership of the note is the issue.
Right.
The lien follows the debt.
The question was, Jay asked, if the note's not recorded, so does the note not matter? Are we not worried about who holds the note? And Jay, go ahead, sorry. Your point was, yeah, we're worried about it.
It's pretty well established that the debt is the thing. Whoever holds the note is the party you want to target, but because notes aren't recorded, it's difficult to tell. Whoever holds the note, the lien is going to follow, the lien will follow the debt.
Would that not sometimes be different than the assignee on the mortgage?
In an ideal world, you'll have an endorsement on the back of the note that corresponds with the assignment of mortgage, or the note will be endorsed in blank. But again, the debtor never sees the note. It's locked away in the vaults of the servicer.
Yeah, occasionally we used to see them when people would bring the standing, back when that was the hot thing, was who has standing to sue. And some servicer would dig out from a dusty vault somewhere or some trust or something an actual physical note. God forbid, two physical notes that didn't match each other. But I think for the most part, and the judges can say if they disagree, we tend to look at the mortgages as the evidence that we've got because we don't see the note.
Well, that's what gets perfected. And
right. Perfection, Judge McGarity says, is important.
To the extent you're talking from the debtor's side.
Right.
The creditor's trying to prove it up to just a question.
Which we rarely have the lien strips with the creditor trying to prove it up. Nope. Creditors don't seem to participate.
Yeah. I mean, what I always say, going back to the complaint, what I always say with the complaint is win the case before you file the complaint. I mean, personally, I attach every single thing I need as an exhibit to my complaint. My complaint's about that thick. And then the only way I'm going to have a challenge is if the mortgage creditor disagrees with the valuation I put down. We'll get to that maybe, hopefully, if we have time. Otherwise, you know, realistically, it's here's everything. Creditor, look at it, take a look, and if they want to complain, they can. I don't get a lot of emails saying, hey, can I get a copy of the BPO that you sent? No, I already gave it to you. It served with you. So I try to win the case before I start. But now probably on to the second fun part of this whole thing, and I don't know who's doing it.
Just add if I can. Okay. As a attorney representing a debtor, your life's going to be made a lot easier if the mortgage company already has started an action somewhere in state court. Mm-hmm. You can rely on the foreclosure pleadings because ideally they will have attached as exhibits the properly endorsed note, the assignments of mortgage. They'll have identified who holds the mortgage in the caption. Similarly, if they've showed up in bankruptcy court and have filed a proof of claim, they may list the servicer, but they're also going to list who holds the note. Feel free to use that when preparing your pleadings. It'll save a lot of headaches down the road.
Yeah, very good suggestion. Okay, so you've pulled together all these documents, hopefully. You've drafted your complaint. You filed it, and now you have to serve it. Andy?
All right.
Thoughts on tracking down who the HE double hockey sticks you have to sell it to?
Well, Rule 7004 governs how you serve a complaint, all right? So I'll just gloss over individual. Most times you're not serving an individual, but that's accomplished by mailing a copy of the summons and complaint to the individual via first-class prepaid mail. Most individuals don't own more, you know, you're typically not stripping a lien from an individual, although on occasion you do run into that. Sub B3, service on a corporation, partnership, or unincorporated association is accomplished by mailing a copy of the summons and complaint via first-class mail, post is prepaid, to the attention of an officer, managing or general agent, or to any agent authorized by appointment or by law to receive service of process. WDFI.org, you can look up registered agents for corporations. The FDIC, Bank Find website, will give you principal places of addresses for any FDIC-insured depository institution, okay? That is the address you want to use. Finding who it is, a lot of times the FDIC site also links you to their website, to the the bank's website, oftentimes they'll have a letter from the president or something like that on there. I always like to then just Google that guy's name and see what comes up, and oftentimes you can kind of try to verify that way. Once you find a name, don't just go with the first name you find. Sometimes it's going to be wrong. Google the name. Okay?
You can actually, when you Google, sometimes trip across, you know, you found Jim Smith, and you find out that Jim Smith, there's a huge news article that Jim Smith left Wells Fargo in a blaze of glory, and now he's the king of Prussia or whatever he is. So you realize that he's not going to be your guy anymore, even though you tripped over a site somewhere that named him.
When you're serving an FDIC-insured institution, it has to be via certified mail, okay? I also like to keep the little receipt. You can track it online real easy, find out if it got where it's going. On occasion, that'll get returned to you. It'll go to the address that's listed on the FDIC site, and it'll come back and say, you need to send it to this address. I usually get an amended summons issued then, and I'll serve it on both addresses again and save both of them. Both of the certificates. Okay? You must serve that summons within 14 days of it being issued, or you're going to have to get a new one. If you miss that deadline, call the court, have them issue an amended summons. Again, don't name the servicer. However, it's a good idea to serve the servicer. I've gotten a lot of stipulations back that way, just because, you know, it's U.S. Bank N.A. as trustee for somebody is the holder. Green Tree Servicing may be the servicer. You're not naming them in the complaint, but you can serve U.S. Bank as trustee for, you know, Irwin Home Equity Securities Series, whatever. And you can serve Green Tree Servicing. I've gotten stipulations back from Green Tree on that quite often, so I encourage you to do that. Just remember, when you have a trust holding the mortgage, you do serve the trustee as trustee for whoever it is. Okay?
Andy, are there any particular entities that you run into real difficulty with? I mean, one that comes to mind for me is City Financial / Citigroup / City Mortgage / City, you know, whatever. There are a million of them.
Yes. That's where you're looking at the recorded mortgage or assignments of mortgage. That'll give you a name. If they're FDIC insured and you go on the FDIC website and they don't exist anymore, they've been merged or something, it'll tell you this entity has been merged without government assistance into, I think, Wells Fargo Financial. I go on there and it's Wells Fargo Bank NA. Well, they've been merged. I usually just print that page off as well, and I'll attach that to my complaint along with the mortgage, because the mortgage may say Wells Fargo Financial NA, and now it's Wells Fargo Bank NA, and I just show that they've been merged. Because you probably won't have an assignment of mortgage for that then. They didn't sell it. That company just has a different name. It's been bought or acquired in some other way.
Mike, what about you? Different practices, other things you do to try to track down the right entity?
It's a lot of fun, but I mean, that's basically what we've come up with, is that similar system is go with what's file the paper trail at the state courthouse, and because that's the only thing you really can do. And then once you find a dead end, then you're spending time on Google, unfortunately. I think we found a newspaper article that said a bank changed their name one time, because we couldn't find it at the FDIC. It just said, this isn't the name, and then we hit a dead end, and we found a newspaper article, oh yeah, they just changed their name from this to this. Okay, well, we used a newspaper article and submitted that as evidence that we had the right name party.
Please explain that in the complaint. So, because we'll see totally different
right.
names in the complaint or in the caption that we see in the document, and we haven't been in that Google trail like you have.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and that's kind of where we're getting at, is trying to get everybody kind of on the same page too a little bit, because I'm sure this is a headache on all your guys' part, because we all do it a little bit differently.
We'll get to the headaches on our part towards the end. Jay, we were talking, when the four of us were preparing for this, I think all three of us had a question for Jay, and that was, you know, is there a rhyme or reason to when a creditor has retained counsel, when it doesn't? Any tips on how to figure out who they are if they haven't retained counsel?
No.
No. Okay, so the next topic.
Everything Andy and Mike mentioned about getting proper service is correct. You should follow that advice, but it may not matter. A lot of the times, adversary proceeding will show up on my desk, and one of the first questions I ask is, were you properly served? More often than not, the lenders don't want to make an issue of it. They're either going to fold their tent, and they'll just say send out a stipulation, or they don't really see a point in litigating personal service, because that case will be dismissed, they'll file another action, get service right, and you're going to end up right back where you are after spending a lot of money to get there. So they just want to get on with things. In terms of what lenders do when they're served, there is no rhyme or reason. And as Mike suggested earlier, it's all driven by value. You know, they've got some reasonably reliable information at their fingertips about what the property is worth. And you know, they'll compare that with what their debt is, and that'll dictate what their future course of action is. Most of the time, with the second mortgages, frankly, they fold. Sometimes they'll see some value there, and they'll suggest that we try to negotiate an acceptable figure. And very, very rarely will they say, we're fully secured, let's litigate this.
Sometimes you've run across an entity that uses the same attorney a lot. I'd like to just use Landmark Credit Union as an example. Mark Darnier may not have appeared in the case yet on anything, but it doesn't hurt to serve him with your complaint. He's usually their attorney. If you know that, there's no harm in serving that attorney. Okay, so let's say they don't want to hire him. So what? As long as you served everybody else, shotgun service isn't going to kill you.
We're usually happy in a situation like this where we don't have a file open for Chase Mortgage, and Andy's kind enough to drop an adversary proceeding on our desk. We'll get in touch with Chase and ask them what they want to do, because the last thing we want to see is they get a default judgment and they find out that we were aware of it and didn't let them know about it. They were served, they can handle it on their own, but still, if we can help them out, we're certainly happy to do that. And it seems to make things more cordial, getting along with debtors' counsel and getting good results.
In the olden days, we called that a courtesy copy. I don't know if they still have that kind of courtesy anymore. And another point I wanted to make is I'm agreeing with everything you're saying here, but be careful the difference between naming somebody as a defendant and serving somebody.
Yes.
I had a firm that they were trying to serve CSC Lawyers Incorporating Service. That's the registered agent of this particular lender. And somebody on the staff, I assume, kept naming CSC as one of the defendants. Well, when our clerk's office opens that case up, you are now suing CSC Lawyers Service, and they don't like that. That's not what you're trying to do. You're not suing the registered agent. You're just serving the registered agent. And as attorneys, we all get that. But if you're turning this over to a staff person, it's incumbent on you to explain it to them so they get it too, because it makes a mess when you've got a defendant. Now, the clerk can't close your case because, well, whatever happened to that defendant? Now you have to file another paper to dismiss as to CSC Lawyers. So, yes, great, serve everybody. That's wonderful. But try to limit your defendants to the ones that you want to avoid the mortgage for. And, again, if you discover later, oh, it wasn't Wells Fargo Financial, now I've learned it's Wells Fargo Bank NA or something, you're not going to just be able to slip a judgment in that goes against who you've now figured out is the right person. So if you want to amend, great, go ahead, but don't try to give us a judgment against somebody you haven't sued.
Yeah, and I mean, and that goes to a point that I was actually going to bring up at one point too, is that we agree there should only be one party listed, and that should be the one on the chain of title at the courthouse. You also should probably put something like plus their heirs and assigns, That way, if you do have a situation, you don't have to recaption the entire thing. You can say, oh, look, but I have an assignment of this note from them, and that way you can bootstrap it into your complaint without having to go through, basically leave for an amended complaint and reservice and waiting another whatever many days.
Although I think most of us will... Well, I think, and I agree with what Judge Halfinger said, which is that, you know, if it has been validly assigned, I don't know that saying and errs and assigns necessarily gets you around that. However, we all know that there are situations where you've tracked the trail as far as you can. You've ended up at the courthouse. You've got a name. You think it's the right name, but we all know strange things happen out there. So at least putting the errors and assigns language in there is a little bit of a backstop. The other comment I wanted to make, going back to Jay, is if you know, if you've got a Mark Darney or you've got a Landmark Credit Union case, or perhaps you know because he's already filed a notice of appearance that Jay's appearing on behalf of Wells Fargo or whatever else, great, serve Jay. Serve Mark Darneyder. Don't serve just Jay or just Mark Darneyder. You still have to serve Wells Fargo by means of a named officer or agent. You still have to serve Landmark.
But
they haven't appeared in the adversary proceeding
right.
yet. Because they
that's their
filed.
Argument.
They've appeared
that's
in the underlying case.
7004H says you can serve an attorney. But 7004 says you can serve an attorney.
Right, but
you're saying it's got to be an attorney that's in the adversary
right.
to commence the action.
And very frequently, at least for me, I see that there's been an attorney who's made an appearance in the underlying, but I've heard hide nor hair of that attorney in the adversary proceeding. Now, that may be, as Jay said, because they've said, you know, we're folding up our tent and we're not going to pay an attorney to battle this when there's no value there. But as we sit here, there's not an attorney of record for that defendant in the adversary proceeding.
Also, some people think that, oh, certified mail is better than first-class mail. And so there's no reason just to send a first-class letter with a plain stamp on it. But yes, there is, because there's a distinction between who you serve by certified mail and who you serve by first-class mail. But it certainly doesn't do any harm to use both for everybody.
If I'm not sure, I'll do certified and first-class mail and just check both boxes on the certificate of service.
Jay?
What about admissions of service? If an attorney agrees to accept service, I've never seen this happen. Theoretically, would that put them adequately into the adversary? That would be sufficient.
The question is whether or not if an attorney has agreed to accept service, if there's an admission of service, will that cover it? I've never seen that either, I guess.
I've seen it one time ago. You don't use that rule much anymore.
Yeah.
I suspect not much here. And also my recollection is unless the bankruptcy rule is different, that also gives more time to answer. I remember seeing it back in the 90s. I don't remember seeing it any time after that.
Yeah, I haven't ever seen it, but I suppose if an attorney said yes,
I did it once, but we already had the entire thing locked up because it was... we did the objection to confirmation. We fought over that. We agreed they were out. And he's like, I'll take service, and then we'll just stip out the adversary proceeding. So, I mean, it was filed, stip, done before you even got... I mean, it was just over within a day or two.
And sometimes you have the informal effective equivalent of that, which is what Jay described. Maybe service hasn't been proper, but the creditors represented, they don't care, they just want to get this show on the road, and so there's no battle over it.
I just don't see it happening very often where you'd have a default. I mean, I couldn't imagine a situation where you'd have a default out of that.
So let's imagine, moving to the next step, that you've effectuated proper service, or maybe even you haven't, and there's an attorney on the other side. So now you're in a position where you've got an actual person to talk to. There's been an answer filed, or even if there hasn't been an answer filed, you've been contacted. And now you want to go about seeing whether or not there's something you can work out so you can avoid having to come visit one of the four of us. Jay, tips and suggestions for debtor's counsel and trying to negotiate these? What sorts of things are the creditors considering? What are you looking for in a stip?
Part of the exhibits, the materials for this morning, are two stipulations that my office typically uses. One is the full detent scenario, where the creditor is just washing their hands of it. They don't want to do any more litigating with respect to this loan. The other one is sort of a, maybe beyond the scope of what we're discussing this morning, it's more of a cram down, where it's a second mortgage, and they'll agree on what the extent of their secured claim is going to be, and the rest is unsecured. And as soon as I get word from my client, we churn those out pretty quickly and get them over to the debtor's attorney. Mm-hmm. What about situations where the lender isn't so swift to cave in? Frankly, we haven't seen that very often. The cases we do have, usually there's a big disparity between the debtor's value of the property and the BPO or appraisal that the lender will have in its loan origination file. And there things get a little more tricky. If the difference is significant but not unmanageable, there's usually hope that common ground can be found. But if the disparity is huge, and I've seen that, then they're going to want to litigate it. So a lot depends on the credibility of the evidence of value. A full-blown appraisal is going to carry a lot more weight with the lender than, you know, my brother-in-law, the guy who lives across the street, thinks that you could get this for your property. That's not going to be as persuasive.
What about a real estate agent? That's, they don't give you free, you know, this is what I market your house for. Is that persuasive?
To some extent.
It's probably a weight issue with a creditor just as much as it's a weight issue. Let's imagine for a moment you had to try one of these or litigate one of these. You know, many of these items, a BPO, an appraisal, the real estate agent's estimate of value, if you will, Bob across the street who knows the last 50 people who've lived there. Some people might even argue Zillow is evidence, but how valuable is that evidence? How much weight is the court going to give it? How much weight is the creditor going to give it? And a certified appraisal report probably is always going to be at the top of your hierarchy of weights. At the bottom of the hierarchy is going to be Bob across the street, just above Zillow.
So the debtor's attorney is going to have to make a judgment call then. How much money do you want to sink into getting a persuasive piece of evidence about the property's value?
I mean, my office's policy has always been, we'll get the broker price opinion. We'll ask where the broker price opinion came from, typically, as well. And then we'll file the case based on that, and if we get into a fight, we'll deal with the fight when it happens. The court can technically appoint a court-appointed appraisal. You can actually pay for it through the estate as an administrative cost. I think I did that once with Judge Shapiro many years ago. However, either that or you tell the debtor, okay, here's where we're at. You can get rid of your second mortgage. That's $50,000, but it's going to cost you a couple hundred bucks to get an appraisal, and we don't know if we'll win. Or I've actually carved out some deals with some second mortgages where they're like, yeah, we know we're way undersecured. Pay us $5,000 on a claim through the plan, and we'll walk away from the second mortgage and kind of carve out a settlement as well. Both of those things have been are good ways to go about things. Talking to the mortgage company is never a bad idea, or their representative isn't a bad idea.
And the starting point can always be the property tax bill. If you're way underwater, if you have $300,000 on a mortgage and the property tax bill says your house is worth $150,000, maybe you don't want to spend the money on an appraisal. Maybe you just want to do the BPO or the CMA or whatever you want to call it. If you owe $150,000 and the property tax bill says $140,000 or $160,000 or $150,000-ish, right around there, maybe you want to spend the money on the appraisal then. Depends on how close it is.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to note on the comparative market analysis is you got to look at them too. Don't just get it and say, oh, my client said it said this much. Most of them, or a lot of them now, give you ranges. Here's a median, here's a high, here's a low, here's the average. And they total them up, and then they say, okay, well, my clients are, you know, if you're in the middle there and the high's over the value of the, but the low isn't, just get something from the broker that says, hey, here's what I think I'd list the price for, here's what I based it on, slap them together, and now you have a comparative market analysis saying one number. Don't give a big giant range. The other thing, when you're drafting the complaint, put the page the value is on in the complaint so the judges don't have to go through 40 pages of broker price opinion to figure out, oh, it was on page 33 that he said the value is whatever. I've gone so far as to circle them and point an arrow at it and then write page 17 on it so that they can flip it open. Oh, page 17. Oh, there's the arrow. There's the number. That's the one I'm supposed to look at for value.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Judge Shapiro made me do that. That was Judge Shapiro's thing.
I hadn't thought of that until you said it, but it sounded real good to me right
yeah.
now.
He's like, mark it at the top of the page, put an arrow, put a circle,
and
write down where it is in the complaint.
Here it is, stupid. And to Mike's point about this comparative market analyses, I have gotten them before where what I have is, you know, this house could be sold for a range of $75,000 to $110,000, and the debtor is saying that the amount that's owed on the first mortgage is $95,000. You either got to come back to me with some kind of number, or I don't think we can go there because that they're. What they've just told me is there's a possibility that the house is, that there is equity. So watch those. I think that's a really good point.
Include the certifications. You know, the appraisal comes with their credentials. I had one where I just didn't, that part wasn't attached to it. So it's just some guy typed it up. Include the credentials with the appraisal or BPO or whatever. Don't use a relative of the debtor. Yeah, my sister's a real estate agent. She'll get me a valuation. That's not good.
So let's get to the really nasty part, at least from the judge's perspective. And this is, you've served it, you've effectuated proper service, you've tracked down the entity, but there has not been an answer filed. And so now you are in default judgment mode. I'll shift back to Mike and ask, so Mike, what's the first thing you do when you now want to obtain a default judgment and you really, really, really don't want to have to track down to the courthouse and visit with one of us?
The first thing I do is I look at what judge I have, because honestly, all four have slightly different policies and procedures.
We know you're shocked. You're shocked. You're stunned.
But you learn them over time. So, I mean, I tried to write down in the outline kind of a little bit of a basic of how everything works. With Judge McGarity, typically, if you hit your 21 days and you're past your default, draft your motion for default judgment. It should attach all the same things your complaint did, prove your whole case, like we said, because the judges are going to look at it from everything from the certificate of service all the way down to the assignment or subordination agreements. Prove the whole case, file your default judgment. And then typically Judge McGarity at the pretrial will kind of look at it and say, okay, yeah, this one's all set, or no, this one's not all set. But she's kind of looking at it right there at the pretrial for the most part is what I've kind of experienced. Judge Kelly, with her procedure, is a little bit more, it's a little slightly different than the others. With Judge Kelly, typically there isn't a pretrial conference. There'll just be a default judgment hearing. And at that hearing, you don't have to bring your debtor, okay? You're showing up to see, is anyone going to show up from the mortgage creditor side? If someone shows up, you'll get an adjournment, and then you'll have your full-blown evidentiary hearing. If no one shows up, then Judge Kelly will look at your service and your proof, and you have to have an affidavit of the debtor of what the debtor would have testified had they been there. If you don't have the affidavit, you got to bring the debtor, okay? Judge Pepper, with hers, it depends on whether you file your motion for default before or the pretrial or after. If you file your motion for default before the scheduled pretrial, Judge Pepper will typically kick the pretrial out to a date beyond the deadline to respond to the default judgment and then make her determination there. If you have an issue on that, you're going to get an in-person hearing with Judge Pepper. If there's anything that she can't just reconcile, you're coming in. And that's, at the end of the day, all the judges kind of will look at, are going to look at everything. That's actually really good for all of us, because 5 years from now, if you wind up getting your judgment and walk into state court and filing this thing and they say no, that's really bad, because now you've already got a discharge case. You have a client who assumes that you voided their second mortgage, and you have a totally worthless judgment against the party that isn't the party you're supposed to have on it. That's malpractice and bad malpractice. So it's actually good that they're hammering us on everything. So make sure you get your stuff right, because you're saving yourself headaches 5-6 years down the line. Now, we're just kind of getting to that point where we've been doing the 506Ds, or the lien stripping avoidance adversaries, heavily now for about the last 5 years, when the market kind of blew up in 2008. So this headache thing may start for some of us, but get your stuff right so you don't have it another 5 years from now.
And just to show you, oh, Todd, sorry.
That if we follow the requirements they set forth, we will have appropriate service, and they'll guarantee that the order that we're getting is going to have the effect that we want in the long term.
You want to repeat the questions?
I mean, my initial thought is my clients are...
Why don't you repeat the question? So
go ahead. The question is, why are we being the title examiners? Why aren't we basically getting a title commitment letter or a title insurance even from a title company to verify who we're supposed to be serving and the legal description of the property, is my assumption.
And if you're foreclosing the property and you're counsel, don't you hire a title insurance company?
First thing.
Right. So why is this any different? We're all setting ourselves up for complaints 5-6 years from now.
So Todd Esser says, as a best practice, you might want to hire the title company and have the title company insure this for you, so you're not struggling through whether you've got proper service, whether you name the correct entity. I'll tack on to Mike's comments that, you know, Mike just talked about why this is good for the debtor to make sure that everything's all there. From the judge's perspective, not to say that we don't care about the debtors, that's not the case, but from our perspective, you're asking us to sign our name to an order taking away property rights from an entity. And if I'm going to do that, and if any of the others of us are going to do that, something inside of us needs to be sure we're taking the property rights away from the entity that actually has them, and that we're doing it based on valid evidence. So, from our perspective, being ticky, I mean, we're trying to do what we understand our jobs to be, which is to make sure that we've got the right defendant and we've got evidence to show that that defendant ought to lose those rights. Now, you didn't comment yet on Judge Halfinger's procedure, and I know that Judge Halfinger in particular has a refined concern with regard to the fact that everybody comes in and says, under 506, I want to strip my lien. And maybe Judge Halfinger might be willing to sort of throw in here about his concern about 506 and whether there might be another statutory option to look at.
He's checking his fantasy football.
Oh.
I'm trying to figure out why everyone seems to think it's 21 days and not 14 days for the default motion.
I think we've just...
It's 14 days, but we just
sort of...
The staff meeting said this is too important, we need to...
Yeah, I don't have a problem with giving more notice. I was just trying to figure out why.
Yeah, it's not... We could have saved you the search.
If it makes you feel better, it used to be different.
Yeah.
Different judges used to do different times, and then finally I think they just all said, if whoever's doing the longest, let's just all do that.
We just wanted to be on the same page so people at least didn't have to keep up with that difference, so that's why. But what about 506?
Right, so it's not so much 506A, it's 506D that people keep invoking, notwithstanding the fact that now after Ryan and whatever that other Seventh Circuit case, it's pretty clear that even though the 506D, the only real use of 506D, I think Dusman actually said this, is to void a security interest when the claim itself is not allowable. Wasn't all that clear about that, but that was the so-called alternative position of the petitioner. and do note that the United States signed on to it amicus, and that Justice Blackmun, running for the court, said the court was accepting. So, you know, in cases from the Seventh Circuit, I think now make that clear that you can't void a lien when the claim is allowable under 506D. So, you know, the question is, what are we doing? I think to the extent one is doing this through an adversary proceeding, what one is doing is asking for a declaration that the claim is unsecured for purposes of 506A. And perhaps, although perhaps the second part is unnecessary, that as an unsecured claim, the rights of the holder of the unsecured claim can be modified pursuant to 1322B. I say perhaps that part's unnecessary because that's what 1322B says. So, you know, unless someone wants to debate that the use of secured claim or unsecured claim in 506 is different than 1322, which I think one can take the position that that's been laid to rest by the Supreme Court, that just follows as a matter of course. But, you know, you can get a declaration of what your rights are, so you could throw 1322 in there. But I think the important part is the 506A issue. But then, right, all these issues that we're talking about, serving the right party and making sure the right party has notice of what's going on, find themselves relocated to the plant. And just to go on probably beyond the scope of Judge Pepper's question, one needs to be careful then that the right party, the same party that is, you know, being declared not to have a secured claim for purposes of the adversary is the party that's mentioned and served in the plan. And that the plan provides how it is that the rights of the holder of that claim are being modified. Yesterday I saw a plan that there's an adversary action and the plan didn't mention the stripping, if you will, the modification of the claim in the plan. So, you know, that's going to be a problem in sort of what the plan says and making sure that there's notice in the plan. But ultimately, the plan is going to be the judgment that does the heavy lifting of modifying the rights of the creditor.
And that's sort of, you know, today we were just focusing on how to deal with your lawsuit, but there's also this whole other plan piece about treating the lawsuit in the plan, and that's probably a topic for another day, but it's something to keep in mind as you're working through this as well, that your plan ought to be addressing this, and Judge Halfinger suggests a way that the plan ought to be addressing it. So we've got the judges having the different procedures perhaps, but in the end, everybody is looking, as Mike said, at the evidence and looking at what you have presented. Andy, you had put together, and it's on the materials in the electronic version on the website, but you had put together some samples or some examples of some sorts of issues of evidence that can arise.
Yeah, I just had, it was a case that involved, you know, we got two recorded mortgages. It was one where the first mortgage was refinanced after taking the second mortgage. So when you look at them on their faces, you've got a second mortgage that is actually has a document number and was recorded before the first mortgage. They've been assigned, so on the website you've got both recorded mortgages, you've got assignments of mortgage, and you've got a subordination agreement, which basically says that, yeah, even though this first mortgage was refinanced and recorded after the second, this second is subordinate to the first. And that's recorded with the county at the Register of Deeds office as well. So that's how you show, you know, if you come without the subordination agreement, the judge is going to say, these are backwards. You can't do this. Your house is, you know, you admit in your complaint your house is worth more than what's owed on this smaller mortgage, which is recorded first and has priority. You need the subordination agreement showing that it's been subordinated. Those are all on the website. It's all from one case. That's why I picked it, so it has all those things on it. The only thing I didn't include is the valuation. You know, get a valuation. I think we all know what those look like. Also make sure you've got proof of the balance of the first mortgage. If they filed a claim, that's wonderful. You've got a claim. Otherwise, a recent mortgage statement is the best way to go there.
Emphasis on recent?
Because again, what you're arguing to the court is, I owe more on the first mortgage than my house is worth. If we can't tell how much is owed on the first mortgage, we can't agree with you. If we can't tell what the house is worth, we can't agree with you. Some of the most common problems, and I hope the other judges will chime in, but I frequently see situations where I can't tell which mortgage is senior and which is junior. I know, the other judges know, I mean, we do have some vague traces of logic, and we understand that if one mortgage is $175,000 and the other is $6,000, it's probably likely that the $175,000 mortgage is the first and the $6,000 is the second. Logic most of the time dictates that. That's not always true. Refis, there are other situations where that's not always true. But logic doesn't get you there. We need to have something, and Andy talked about the mortgage numbers, the recording numbers, and the dates at the top right-hand corner, usually, of the recorded mortgage. If we see those, if we see the numbers, that's helpful. It is amazing how many times, though, we don't have that. It's simply not provided. You can't tell which is which. Another very common problem is the one Judge McGarity made reference to earlier. The complaint says, you know, John Smith versus Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo is smeared all over the complaint. Wells Fargo's in the plan. Wells Fargo's everywhere. And we get our documentation, and we're starting to review, and we look over it, and Wells Fargo is not mentioned anywhere on a single solitary piece of paper anywhere in the evidence that we've got, which starts to raise questions in our minds about did you sue the right person? What's the connection? We assume that the mortgage made it from somewhere to Wells Fargo, but you don't haven't given us the link. So that goes back to Mike's discussion about assignments and things of that nature. The other favor that I would ask, and maybe the other judges would agree, Mike said that he attached all of his evidence to the complaint, which is great, and maybe that'll get Jay Pittner to call up Mike and say, let's talk something out if he sees what's attached. But by the time we get to default judgment, I frequently see a one-page motion for default judgment. They didn't answer, so we win. And so then what happens is, maybe if it's Mike Maloney, we go back and we look at everything and it's attached to the complaint. A lot of times it's not.
I actually put it on the judgment, not the motion for default, too.
You do. That's correct. And that's what I was going to ask. We're not trying to make extra work for you, but if you attach it again to your motion for default judgment, you avoid getting hauled into court for a hearing in front of one of the four of us with us saying, we can't find any of this. And people go, well, I'm pretty sure it's attached to the proof of claim. I'm pretty sure that I filed it in the underlying bankruptcy for some reason or another.
We're not going to go hunting for it.
Especially if the government shutdown continues and we don't have staff to go hunting for it. We're not going to go looking. So if you attach those things to the motion for default judgment, you very possibly save yourself a visit to one of us because we can see it all already. I don't know if there are other issues you could...
I just think of this as there's two steps here. There's a default. That's what you get when they didn't file an answer. And then there's a judgment. That's what you get when you prove you're entitled to it.
Right.
And we four have different methods of how you prove that, but that we all agree you have to prove more than they didn't answer.
Right.
I mean, if this was just a case for he owes me $100, you can get your default and your judgment, the clerk can enter it. But this is a case where you're trying to avoid a mortgage, so you need to prove that, and we need to be able to walk through it, and the easier you make that, the easier it's going to be on everybody.
Judge Halpern, did you have a comment?
So reasonable people can probably differ about what exactly the law is on when a court can enter the default judgment, but that's not what I wanted to ask. So earlier we were talking about the whole notion of the holder of the note versus the holder of the mortgage, and the fact that it's difficult from the debtor's position, certainly, to figure out who actually holds the note, because it could have been transferred God knows how many times up to the time that the complaint comes about. That being said, I think Jay's point about who the actual party in interest is correct, that say it's the holder of the note. I don't think there is, you know, if one finds that the mortgage is in the name of X Bank, that is the recorded person who has the mortgage, to say that, look, X Bank holds the note in the mortgage. I mean, somebody can tell me I'm wrong about this, but it strikes me that, unless the debtor has information to the contrary, But that strikes me as sufficient to make a well-pleaded allegation that the defendant here, X-Bank, holds the note in the mortgage. And so that way, the complaint alleges, you know, who the proper party in interest is, and as best the plaintiff can figure out. And then, you know, it's a question for litigation. And that strikes me as, and again, maybe somebody would debate this, that strikes me as a well-pleaded allegation. Maybe it's a legal conclusion, but, you know, there's a sense in which if someone says, I hold a note, you know, that really means, it means sort of two things. One, you know, I have the legal right to enforce it. It might actually be that, you know, I have possession of it, and that's why I have a legal right to enforce it. So in any event, I think that, you know, in the absence of some other facts or a defendant coming in and contesting the matter, that strikes me as a well-pleaded allegation. And we, you know, one can proceed from there, assuming it's sort of backed up with the rest of this that everybody's been talking about.
And I think that's true, particularly given the fact that I know in Wisconsin at any rate, and I think under the UCC, that the mortgage follows the note. So, I mean, that was all the hoo-ha with MERS, was that there was a period in time where those two things were getting divorced and they shouldn't have been, and nobody could quite figure out how MERS was accomplishing that feat. I think we've kind of gotten past the MERS days, maybe, finally. But
about 3 minutes, so you want to
talk
about the order?
I do want to talk about the order. The last document that you'll see, and I want to give my thanks to Mike and Andy for doing the outline that you have. They did a terrific job. The last document with the big draft stamp on the back is an order that the four of us, the four judges, have come up with. It was not actually a solution in search of a problem. We were seeing all manner of orders. Once we finally looked at the evidence and we decided, okay, you've got enough and we're ready to enter the default judgment, as Judge Kelly indicated, we were seeing orders that said all sorts of interesting things. We were seeing orders, draft orders, that said things like, you know, if the mortgage company doesn't release the mortgage within 45 days of the discharge or completion of the plan, the bankruptcy court will do it. The bankruptcy court will satisfy the mortgage. I wouldn't have the foggiest notion how to satisfy a mortgage, and I'm not entirely sure that I'm allowed to. So I was not signing orders that said that. I think other people were not signing them. We were seeing all sorts of weird things in there. We were seeing, as you can imagine, every iteration of avoid the mortgage, satisfy the mortgage, cancel the mortgage, release the mortgage, dismiss the mortgage. All kind of versions of that. So the four of us sat down and put our heads together and tried to come up with an order that we felt like each of the four of us would be comfortable signing. We had a good deal of debate back and forth, given that, as many of you know, if the model Chapter 13 plan goes into effect in 2015, there will be rules changes. And a lot of those rules changes we thought about and thought, you know, well, is this kind of coming inevitably and it will change our practices anyway, so maybe we should think about that in the order. Maybe it's not coming inevitably. Maybe even if it isn't, we think it's a good idea. And so this is the order that we came up with. What we were hoping is that you all will take this with you today, look at it and review it, and give us ideas. You can shoot us an email, or if you don't feel comfortable shooting one of us an email, you can contact one of these guys and tell them. I mean, Jay's called me before and said, you know, just want to let you know there's kind of noise out in the community about something, and we listen to that. So if you'd rather not contact one of us, you can contact one of them. But let us know if there's something in here that simply does not work real world with the way you all function. One of the comments that both Andy and Mike made when they first saw this, you'll notice that on the first page, we have a statement that says the property as described in the attached property description or something along those lines. Both Mike and Andy said, oh, please, we'd like the legal description of the property in the order, because when it gets recorded, the legal description of the property needs to be in the order. We can do that. We could stick a field in here where you could plug in your legal description of your property. So that's the kind of suggestion that we're looking for. You will note, in addition, that the last page, page 2, paragraph 5, says, upon completion of the plan, an entry of the order granting the plaintiff's discharge, the lien will be satisfied. Everybody knows, as do we, that the law is somewhat unsettled across the country with regard to whether or not there needs to be a discharge in order to satisfy the lien, or whether or not completion of the plan is sufficient. We went back and forth. We argued. We discussed. We tried to be reasonable with each other. This is what we came up with. So there it is. and
well,
you could.
Well, the discharge would meet the contingency. Maybe completion of the plan will too. And so that's one of those stay tuned things. But
right.
We know that at least on the granting of the discharge that it will work. I would also add, I issued my dissent as to the form of this this order. That last sentence says, if the defendant fails to release its lien upon completion of that plan and granting the discharge, the plaintiff may seek additional relief to effectuate this order. I would suggest that that asks for the defendant to actually do something. And it seems to me that if it doesn't end up on some functionary's desk for 3 months while they're trying to scratch their heads as to whether they want to actually do something to release the lien or whether this order itself satisfies the lien, is going to be problematic. So I wouldn't suggest that they come back to bankruptcy court. I'm not sure we can force them to do anything, but it's the order that releases the lien, not the release by the defendant. Because I think what's going to happen, this is going to show up 6 years down the road when you've already posted, you don't know the person, they're trying to sell their house and trying to refinance or something, and the second mortgage holder is saying, well, I don't know whether I want to release the lien or not. And that's the point where they, you know, start fighting, and you've lost your interest rate, you've lost your buyer, and you've also got a client who is just mad as hell and remembers you even if you don't remember him. And so,
yeah, I mean, traditionally, we've always put in the order that this is the order. We're going to file this okay. at the court. And this is what we would take down and put in.
I would say
whether a title company will accept this.
Yes.
They take it all the time.
What authority is the court have for issuing an order that releases the lien or whatever word you want to
use? Satisfies the
lien. I mean, the order. Well, the order says if the lien's satisfied.
Okay, and how?
It's a satisfaction of judgment. Discharge 1322A5.
Yeah, okay. So then the operative order is the confirmation order.
Right, which we usually attach a copy of the discharge order that says all liens are released upon discharge and a copy of this order that says upon discharge this lien's released.
All this is a document telling you that you have an unsecured claim.
And by the way, you can see that we are not all on the same page
yeah,
on this.
They take it. I've been doing it for 10 years.
That's probably all you guys care about is that they'll take it. But two quick points to finish this up. The reason that this discussion arose among us was because if those rules go into effect in 2015 around the model plan, the modified rules will require a return to the bankruptcy court at the completion of the plan to get some additional something. So if that rule goes into effect, that will be what you'll have to do. Jay made a suggestion. He said very frequently people just shoot him the order of discharge at the end once the debtor gets the discharge, and that's good by him.
All my clients want to see a discharge. If you look at the stipulations I prepared and provided, it's all contingent upon a discharge. So that's the important event.
And with that, I guess we're way over our time, but thank you for your indulgence.
Thanks, everybody, for coming in for our panel. That was really good. Stay tuned and come back next month for the Supreme Court presentation and then in
open.
December for ethics. Thanks again.
Thank you, guys.